Position number 20583, Wheel 2.
Mr. Dewsbury, Rail 2.
Well, I was a bit paranoic about the thing in case I was dropped off the course and sent back to sea again. So I spent all my spare time mugging up everything I could in order to get a good result in the examinations, which turned out to be all right in the end. When we completed the thing, the course, people were sent off in various directions, such as back to Portsmouth to the barracks for some sort of extra training, and coastal forces, MTBs, MLs, minesweepers and so on. I was told to report to the Admiralty, to NA2SL, which stands for Naval Assistant to Second Sea Lord, who dealt with personnel appointments. And he said that I was appointed to the Western Isles, which was berthed, HMS Western Isles, which was berthed in Tobermory. I travelled up by train and got the ferry from Oban to Tobermory, and I reported on board the next morning to be met by a Commodore who I had never heard of before, but he'd become quite famous, Commodore Stevenson, who was responsible for working up newly commissioned escort vessels to prepare them for the going out into the Battle of the Atlantic. And he came striding across and said, "Where's the other officer? I sent for two," and he looked quite suspiciously at me as though I should know something about it, and I didn't know there was supposed to be two officers. And I stayed on board the Western Isles for a few weeks. And during that period, we had many escort vessels arriving, newly commissioned, crews fresh from shore, and he chucked them into sort of fighting units and became quite famous for it. He must have handled hundreds of ships during the period of the war.
What did you think of him?
Well, he was an absolute dynamite, really, and he really put some life into these various green crews that arrived from all over the place, in trawlers, corvettes, mostly corvettes, but there were also sloops and frigates. I think before the war ended he'd passed 1,000 ships through his hands, through his training schemes. And must have contributed enormously to the success of the Battle of the Atlantic.
What exactly was Western Isles?
She was an old Dutch ferry, formerly called Batavia 7 or something like that, quite old. And she had training equipment aboard, but mostly the exercises were carried out at sea. Then another ship arrived, which was renamed the Eastern Isles, and she was an Isle of Man ferry. This was in 1941, and I noted that the plate in her engine room said she was built in 1891, so she was just 50 years old, coal burning. And I was appointed to go to her as navigator. And we would then move around the western approaches from one port to another with our equipment, carrying out the same sort of job of training or retraining anti-submarine vessels.
How did you like all this at Tobermory?
I don't remember a great deal about it now. We seem to be always dashing about on it because we were sent hither and thither by the Commodore, and I don't have a great deal of recollection about Tobermory at all.
Were you happy?
Oh yes, yes, quite happy really with that. And the new ship that arrived, well new, the converted old ship, the captain was in his 60s, as was Commodore Stevenson. And the captain of the Eastern Isles had retired as a lieutenant commander before the First War. He'd come back for the First War and had been promoted on the retired list, so he was also a foreign captain. And I got on quite well with him. As navigator, most of the time it wasn't so much navigation really as pilotage, because you spent most of your time putting minefields on the chart and the swept channels, which were often being changed, and you had to keep these things up to date in order to ensure you have made a clear passage. And the places we visited were Lam Lash in Campbelltown in Mull of Kintyre, and Gladstone Dock in Bootle, Albert Dock in Liverpool, and over on the north side of the Mersey, Birkenhead. And we had attack teachers on board, which was equipment that simulated attacks on submarines, and which were manoeuvred by some other person trying to make the attack as difficult as possible. And we had AS crews, anti-submarine crews, from corvettes mostly, for retraining and improving of their, mostly the captain of the corvette really, how he handled his ship during an attack on a U-boat.
What did an attack teacher look like?
Well, it had there was a table with a glass surface, and underneath was the submarine moving about, which was moved by one of the operators at the sort of speed a submarine could do, sort of around about 6 knots maximum underwater. And then there was the whatever wheel orders or engine orders the captain gave, moved his corvette on the table around hunting the submarine, and the echoes were transmitted back. If they were in contact, they got an echo. If they weren't in contact, they didn't get an echo. So it was as realistic as an attack as you could make it. And of course the operators of the U-boat became very accomplished and at evading the corvette on this table.
So did the corvette operators become accomplished at sinking them?
Well, after a time, yes. Yes. So it was all good practice, and we did this in the various ports of Western Approaches. I have to say it was all interspersed with, particularly down in Liverpool in Merseyside, with heavy air raids which were going on at the time, particularly in Gladstone Dock, where there were near misses on the dock side, and heavy fires were caused by the raids. So in effect it was more dangerous in harbour than at sea.
What did public morale seem to be like in Bootle and in Portsmouth in the air raids?
Well, in Portsmouth, the morale was, the second time I went, was very low, in the sense that when we arrived from north, the platforms on the other side were crowded with people wanting to just get out of Portsmouth, because it was quite a target. So I think their morale was pretty low, really. In Liverpool, I wasn't aware that the morale was low. I think they were accepting the fact that these raids were just going to go on, and which they did. And I suppose we were more aware, being in the dock area, of the fires and destruction than other parts of Liverpool, which probably got away unscathed.
Did you feel frightened in the air raids?
Well, oddly enough, you felt more frightened if you were on shore. Then when you felt safer on board your ship, and yet you were in a target area in the docks. But you were in familiar surroundings, whereas if you're wandering around ashore, you didn't know what to do or where to go. So that was more frightening than being on board ship. After about 6 months of this, as far as I recollect, my captain seemed to have some influence at the Admiralty, so I asked him if I could get a transfer to a destroyer. And he used to make frequent visits, because of his seniority, to the Admiralty and talk to people. And I was sent on a round of destroyer courses, which were curtailed. I spent 2 week period at Campbelltown on anti-submarine work, and when they realised where I'd come from, because they had attack teachers ashore there in Campbelltown, they curtailed it, and I did just a simple week there. But I did 6 weeks at Whale Island in Portsmouth, that's HMS Excellent, doing gunnery, destroyer gunnery. And then I spent 1 week in Devonport at HMS Defiance doing a torpedo course. Defiance was an old wooden hulk which had equipment on board for training in the mechanics of torpedoes. The end of the week there, whilst there was an air raid going on, a signal came in saying I was appointed to HMS Beaver, which is spelt Belvoir, which was a Hunt-class destroyer, and I found out that she was operating in Scapa Flow. So I set off the next morning to Scapa Flow, which took quite a while, really. Getting up to the north of Scotland to Thurso, and then getting the ferry. And I joined her in Scapa Flow, and it transpired that I was to relieve a lieutenant, RNR. I don't know why the captain didn't want him, but he persuaded the captain to let him go straight away instead of, he was supposed to do a turnover, but he left straight away. And I took over his job, or was going to take over his job as navigator. But after about an hour's consideration, the captain changed his mind and appointed one of his other officers as navigator, and appointed me as torpedo officer and ASDIC control officer. We were left almost immediately with part of the home fleet to provide a covering force for a Russian convoy. We were part of a ploy which had been used quite a lot. We weren't sailing with the convoy, we were between the convoy and Norway in case the convoy should be attacked by a surface raider. We would be able to cut them off before they could return to their base. And we had with us an aircraft carrier, Victorious, and one or two battleships, as far as I remember. And the weather was appalling, as it always was, in my experience, up in the North Atlantic and going up around Iceland. Anyway, we had no... the weather was so bad that there was no danger of U-boats operating, and probably aircraft either. We weren't attacked, although I think we were shadowed for quite a while.
Do you know the name of this convoy?
The convoy? No, I don't know now, no. We left the escort and went into Seyðisfjörður, I think it was, in Iceland, to refuel. And then rejoined to pick up the convoy, to cover the convoy of the empty vessels returning back from North Russia, and which we did. We had no incidents at all. There was no trouble. We had no U-boat trouble, and we had no aircraft trouble. And the convoy, as far as I know, both convoys proceeded quite unscathed.
Which season of the year was it?
It was round about February of this would be of 1942, I guess. That's only an estimate that I can make. We arrived back in Scapa Flow and were sent round to Greenock for the ship to boiler clean. And the captain said to me that we were in fact going to the Far East, and that we would each have 2 days leave from Greenock, which was during which period I would have to get myself fully equipped with tropical gear, which I hadn't got because I'd never needed any before, and which I did, and we then formed part of the escort of a troop convoy which was being taken round the Cape and consisted of Union Castle liners, P&O liners, and one or two American ships. And I think, as far as I remember, we had in this convoy somewhere around 55,000 troops. And we had an escort of, it was quite a fast convoy, because I think all the ships were capable of about 18 knots, whereas the North Atlantic convoys of old tramp steamers and things were lucky if they could make 8 or 9 knots. So the escort consisted of destroyers and one cruiser, which was the Mauritius. They, apart from the Mauritius and another Hunt-class destroyer, which was the Horsley, the escort all peeled off when we got well out into the Atlantic and we turned south then. And Hunt-class destroyers did not have a very good range, and we had to go into the Azores to Ponta Delgada to refuel and rejoin the convoy, which then had simply 2 Hunt-class destroyers and the Mauritius. And our next port of call was Freetown in Sierra Leone, and we refueled there and spent a couple of days there for some reason, I'm not quite sure why, and then carried on taking this convoy south. And we had to go off after a few days to St Helena, where there was a tanker, and we refueled at St Helena and then carried on round to Cape Town, or towards Cape Town. During the night, one night, whilst I was on watch, one of the large American liners dropped out of line and started to fall astern, and I told the signalman to call her up, and with a small night light, and she said she'd lost an American soldier overboard sometime during the night, and she was going back to look for him, which seemed quite ludicrous that she was going to endanger another 3,000 men to look for one. So I made to resume your station and call the captain. And it seemed ludicrous, really, that me, about 19 years old, was telling an American captain of a liner to go back into his station, which he did, in fact. And we ourselves backtracked along our course to see if there was any sign of this man, which of course there wasn't. On a black night in the South Atlantic, there was no hope of ever finding anybody. We arrived in Cape Town and were sent round to Durban and immediately sent out on patrol, because there was a belief that the Japanese were going to attack with midget submarines. Anyway, we patrolled outside Devon for quite some time, and there was no sign of any activity. And we then went round to the South African naval base of Simonstown. We restored there and set off for Madagascar, which we'd captured from the French. And we went round to Diego Suarez in the north end of the island, simply to refuel. By this time, we were operating with only the other Hunt-class destroyer and the Mauritius. Mauritius left us there, went in fact to do a visit to Mauritius on a morale-boosting, flag-showing visit before proceeding to wherever she was going. We rendezvoused with the Shropshire, a county-class cruiser, and refueled at sea, which was the first time we'd done this operation with another naval ship. We'd done it with a tanker, but not with another naval ship. And after Diego Suarez, we went to Kilindini, which is the port for Mombasa, which was to be a temporary base for the Eastern Fleet, which duly arrived a few days after us. And things were going badly in the Mediterranean. Greece had fallen and Crete had just been captured by the Germans. And I think the Mediterranean CNC had requested the loan of destroyers. And so we, the Hunts, were sent, Hursley and ourselves, the Beaver, which was probably right because we were most unsuitable for the Indian Ocean, the distances involved in the Indian Ocean, because we couldn't carry sufficient fuel. So we left Kilindini and went to refuel again. I keep mentioning refuel, which just shows you how often we had to refuel. It was one of the prime considerations of getting out round the Cape was how long your fuel would last. I refueled at Aden and went up to Suez and passed up the canal and arrived in Port Said. And that afternoon, and that we were immediately told, sent instructions on board and signals in telling us we were part of a bombarding force that was going out to bombard Mersa Matruh, which was the main port on the German side of Alamein. So we were going out there to bombard in case there were any store ships that had got through with supplies, and the idea was we'd sink them in the harbour or set any stores on fire. So we were barely in the Mediterranean for a few hours before we were out on a bombarding mission. And we had two Dido-class cruisers, I think, Dido and Cleopatra, probably. And we carried out a bombardment, and then suddenly one of the Hunt-class destroyers already out there, the Erige, was sighted a E-boat and opened fire, but the E-boat had already fired a torpedo and the Erige was struck in the gearing room and was totally out of action. The cruisers went back to Port Said and again, Hunt class got the Erige in tow, but her wheel was jammed hard over, as far as I can remember, and the towing was difficult. She was wanting to go around in circles. Anyway, we got her to Alexandria, and she was a write-off. She was only used for an accommodation, as an accommodation vessel in Alexandria for the rest of the war. That was our first experience of the Mediterranean. We then moved to Alexandria, which was our base for the next 2.5 years. Whichever ship I was in, its base was always Alexandria, although we might not see Alexandria for weeks, months on end. And on a personal note, my brother had come out to the Mediterranean in an assault ship called the Glen Roy, which had been damaged in the evacuation of Crete, where she was used not for evacuation purposes as opposed to invasion purposes. And he was then running a landing craft to Tobruk, and I found him ashore, and because he was allowed to live ashore, because his these landing craft were just impossible to live aboard in harbour. And I no sooner found him than I was recalled, because there was some panic. They had a very efficient system of recalling in Alexandria. They used to flash it up on cinema screens or broadcast it around all the various bars in the